From NPR News, this is Day to Day. The Justice Department says it's busted a major international identity theft ring. The suspects originally stole more than 40 million debit and credit card numbers. Prosecutors say these high-tech criminals hacked into the computer networks of such retailers as Barnes & Noble and TJ Maxx, among others. Marketplace's Amy Scott is here now. And Amy, apparently the defendants used a tactic that is called war driving. What is war driving?
Well, it's as scary as it sounds. The defendants allegedly drove around shopping mall parking lots with laptops looking for wireless internet signals, and then were able to somehow hack into these retailers' networks and capture millions of debit and credit card numbers. 11 people from 5 countries have been charged, including a Secret Service informant who could face life in prison. They're accused of selling credit card numbers on the black market, as well as using the stolen numbers to withdraw thousands of dollars at a time from ATMs.
Wow. So 40 million of these numbers, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have shopped at Barnes & Noble and TJ Maxx or any of the other stores. Should they be nervous?
Well, I put that question to Peter Swire. He teaches privacy law at Ohio State University. Some of these cases date back several years, so it's likely that any damage has already been done. But Swire says people should still check their credit records.
If you shopped at these stores, then your credit card quite possibly was compromised. That's a reason to check your credit card records to make sure that no one else is using it. And it could be a reason to check your credit history using the free credit reports to make sure no one has gone and tried to do identity theft on you.
To access a free credit report, Swire says people should go to the Federal Trade Commission website.
Okay, so let's say I do that and I discover a problem. What happens next? Do I get my money back?
If somebody steals your credit card number, your maximum loss is $50. The bank that issued the credit card is ultimately on the hook. Now, if it's a debit card that's linked directly to your bank account, it can be a little harder to get your money back. And of course, if there's any damage to your credit score, that can take a long time to sort out and can potentially cost a lot of money as well.
So what safeguards are authorities putting in the wake of this bust to make it more secure, to make our cards more secure?
Well, ultimately, it's the job of the retailer's IT people to keep their networks safe. Peter Swire says this case does send a strong signal to criminals. But another privacy expert I talked to today told me that consumers should basically assume that they're going to be victims of identity theft and act accordingly.
All right. Well, thank you, Amy, for that sobering report. Amy Scott of Public Radio's Daily Business Show Marketplace.
Trying to track down the anthrax killer, the FBI investigators needed to create new science in bacteriology. For more, we turn to NPR's David Kestenbaum, who's with the NPR Science Desk. David, FBI sources are quoted as saying that their scientists literally were inventing science, microbial forensics. What is that? Why was it necessary?
Well, when the anthrax showed up in the mail, we didn't even have a full sequence of the anthrax genome to start with. You know, just sequencing technology has come a long way. The stuff we can do now, you can sequence a whole genome in a very short period of time, and it was a much longer effort in the past. So their first analysis was they looked at the DNA in the spores and they found, hey, this is the Ames strain. But it turns out the Ames strain of anthrax was in a number of labs, so that wasn't so helpful. So they had to look even closer. And what they found is that in the spores that were in the letters, they weren't all exactly the same kind of spores. There was some small mixture of a couple other types in there at a low level, and they were able to match that with a sample of anthrax bacteria at Fort Detrick.
So they are looking at the genetic makeup of the particular anthrax bacteria that they'd found. And
Think of it this way. So, like, I mean, if you had a bucket of rice, right?
Yeah.
And they're mostly white grains of rice, but in there are a few ones that are brown. And you know that a certain country tends to produce that mixture. Well, then you'd say, I have some confidence that this rice came from that country. It's like that, except that the ones that are a different color, they're not that easy to tell. You have to actually look into their genome along the many, many, many chemical letters, and you'll find a slight, slight difference. So it's very difficult.
So what is it that these scientists were doing? What were they creating along the way to try to solve the mystery of who had perpetrated this crime?
Well, they were trying to figure out where the anthrax had come from, right? I mean, it'd be nice if you could narrow it to a particular lab. And for this, they were able to show that it matched the stuff at this lab.
Well, can they figure out when these spores were made?
Yeah, there was actually some really interesting science done fairly early on where they carbon dated the spores. You know, you hear about carbon dating for looking at dinosaur bones, but you tend to think of millions of years, right? They were able to narrow it to within about a couple years. And this is due to some strange fact that when we did all the above ground atomic nuclear tests, we put a certain isotope of carbon in the air, and that makes it into the water that was used to grow the spores. And the amount of carbon in the air is sort of declining over the years since we stopped the testing. So by using that, you can kind of figure out when the spores were made. It's actually been used to tell whether someone has a stuffed endangered species, whether that was killed before they became endangered or whether maybe it was killed in a time when it would have been illegal.
I've read statements from the FBI. They're clearly very excited about what they've managed to do scientifically in labs to figure this out. But as a science reporter, is this proof?
It's not. I mean, it would be very interesting to see how this played out in a court of law. And unfortunately, it does not look like it will. Microbial forensic has just not – it hasn't appeared in court. DNA fingerprints are one thing. You know, if the cops find DNA from you at the scene of a crime, it's just not going to match anyone else on Earth unless maybe you have a twin or something. You know, but this sort of matching we're talking about with the spores, it's much more iffy. And so it'd be interesting to see how much weight that evidence carried in court.
NPR's David Kestenbaum. Thanks, David.
You're welcome.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Today, the country's largest cable company and its second largest internet service provider got a scolding. The Federal Communications Commission voted to reprimand Comcast for secretly interfering with some internet traffic. And with that vote, the federal government was stating its support for net neutrality, the idea that all internet traffic should be treated equally. Joel Rose has the story.
To explain what Comcast did wrong on the internet, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin turned to another company that's equally renowned for its customer service, the U.S. Postal Service.
Would anyone here actually be okay if the post office was opening your mail and deciding that they didn't want to bother delivering it and hiding that fact by sending back to you stamped address unknown return to sender? Unfortunately, this is exactly the practice that Comcast was engaging in.
Last year, Comcast was caught interfering with the traffic of customers using peer-to-peer file sharing programs such as BitTorrent, a popular way of exchanging large files like movies. Comcast is also in the business of distributing movies, and critics charged it was thwarting competition. At first, Comcast denied the charges, until independent tests proved it was impeding certain applications. The company then claimed it was engaged in, quote, reasonable network management.
Blocking competitors is not reasonable network management.
Marvin Amori is a lawyer for Free Press, the nonprofit group that filed a formal complaint with the FCC in November.
And while there might be gray areas of what's reasonable and what isn't, this is not a gray area. This is clearly unreasonable.
Today, a divided FCC agreed. The commissioners voted to reprimand Comcast for violating internet principles the commission adopted in 2005 and then lying about it. At the meeting, Commissioner Michael Copps argued that the FCC should adopt an additional principle, one guaranteeing network neutrality, the idea that all data should be delivered at the same speed regardless of what it is or who it's from.
A clearly stated commitment of non-discrimination would make clear that the commission is not having a one-night stand with net neutrality, but an affair of the heart and a commitment for life.
That's exactly what Adam Thierer is afraid of. He's a fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation in Washington.
It's the beginning of a serious regulatory regime for the internet. It's the foot in the door for some in government to try to regulate various types of internet activities,
including content. Thierer would rather see the market pushing companies like Comcast to behave themselves, something he says is already happening. After an avalanche of bad press, Comcast announced it would voluntarily change its network management practices. And the company made peace with BitTorrent Incorporated. So Comcast Vice President Joe Waz says there's no remaining reason for the FCC to get involved.
Has the marketplace responded? Has Comcast responded in ways that are positive for the consumer? The answer is yes. And the agency, in my view, could say, mission accomplished, let's move on.
Comcast has not said if it will appeal today's FCC order, but the company's lawyers are already asking whether the commission has the legal authority to enforce its internet principles. Commissioner Robert McDowell, who voted against the order, says the agency should have crafted formal rules instead of reacting to a single complaint.
This matter would have a better chance on appeal if we had put the horse before the cart and conducted a rulemaking, issued rules, and then enforced them.
But FCC Chairman Kevin Martin insists the commission is on solid legal ground, and he says Comcast's bad behavior left the FCC no choice but to act.
If we aren't going to stop a company that is looking inside its subscribers' communications, blocking the communication when it uses a particular application, hiding what it is doing by making its consumers think that the problem is their own, and lying about it to the public, what would we stop?
The FCC did not impose a fine on Comcast, but it did order the company to report back on how it's changing its network management policy. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
The earth has mostly stopped rumbling in Southern California, but people there are still talking about Tuesday's quake. While it didn't cause much damage, NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates says the quake did serve as a reminder of what could happen.
Earthquakes are scary, but even when things are shaking hard, most Angelenos remain pretty calm. LA TV anchors just threw the quake into their broadcast as it happened.
I believe we are having...
Oh, a big one.
Yeah, a big earthquake right now.
And a city council member barked the announcement to his colleagues and visitors during a debate about collecting recyclables.
I know this is a lot of money you're talking about. And there goes the earthquake. Earthquake, earthquake.
We're experiencing an earthquake.
Earthquake.
And, of course, this being Los Angeles, people across the city, like this guy, had one thing on their minds as soon as the shaking stopped.
Obviously, the first thing we thought to do was make a video.
And he wasn't alone. There are scores of them on YouTube now, like this man, mourning a lost opportunity.
So, shaky shake. Man, I'm so bummed. I wanted to have the camera on while this was happening.
Two members of LA City Council decided to use this moderate quake as a teachable moment. They're hammering home the need for everyone to prepare for the big one. Councilwoman Wendy Gruhl.
Today, we're here at the Northridge Mall, which really was the scene of the 1994 earthquake, where you really had visuals of what an earthquake can do and its strength.
The 6.7 Northridge quake was serious enough to kill at least 61 people, mostly from collapsed buildings, and cause over $20 billion in damage. But 14 years have passed, the area has recovered, and Gruhl says people do the human thing.
People kind of forget, and so we want to seize this opportunity, take control and say, we're going to prepare people in the city for an earthquake. It is inevitable. All of the statistics will show that we will have a major earthquake in this region, and so we need to be prepared.
That being said, nobody can be prepared for what we believe is coming in the next 2 decades or so.
That's Gruhl's council colleague, Greg Smith. Smith has worked on earthquake preparedness for decades. He's referring to a recent study that predicts a catastrophic quake, the so-called big one, will hit Southern California in the next 30 years. The predictions are especially grim if a quake hits downtown L.A. on a weekday.
There could be loss of 10,000 lives downtown, and the biggest loss of life comes from flying glass.
Out in the neighborhoods, preparedness will allow residents to survive until first responders can reach them, which will probably take days. Volunteers David Young and his wife May believe everyone should take the free county emergency training they got.
The whole training is not really asking you to be a professional, but give us enough basic skills so that we can survive.
Planning is essential. LAPD Deputy Chief Mike Moore says people plan their vacations, their budgets, even what they'll have for lunch.
But then you ask them, how much water do you have? How much food do you have for your family? How would your pet survive? What supply of medicines do you have?
Good question. This week's quake is being heralded as a shake-up call to jolt Angelenos out of their complacency. Wendy Gruhl says with each quake, the county learns more to prepare for the next one.
That's what these wake-up calls are about, is to look at how we can do it better.
So they can be prepared not if, but when the big one hits. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Now for Senator Obama's tech policy ideas, we go to Bill Kennard. He's also a former chair of the FCC under President Clinton. He's now an advisor on technology and media issues for the Obama campaign. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Could you explain Senator Obama's plan for what Mr. Powell referred to as a top tech guy, or perhaps gal? What would a tech czar do?
Senator Obama has called for the creation of a new cabinet-level position, which he would call the Chief Technology Officer. And that individual would be responsible for making sure that the federal government imports from the private sector the best technology tools to make government work better. Things like making sure that all of the government agencies have cutting-edge technology, making sure that our government is much more transparent, making sure that we're reaching out to the public to get some of their best ideas on how we can govern the country.
Simply put, how would you explain his philosophy when it comes to the role of federal government in tech policy? Is it something that's very activist or more of a hands-off approach?
Well, it's certainly more activist than John McCain. Senator Obama understands that the future of our economy depends to a large extent on how we can ensure that Americans have access to technology and we empower Americans to use it. I've had a lot of experience with John McCain. He was chairman of the Commerce Committee when I was chairman of the FCC. So his view is starkly different from Senator Obama. I'll give you a few examples. When the Clinton administration went to implement a policy to make sure that all school children in America had access to the internet in their schools, Senator McCain vigorously opposed it. Senator Obama not only embraces that policy, but wants to take it to the next level to make sure that not only school children in America have access to dial-up internet, but they have access to broadband internet.
Now, we just heard Michael Powell, who acknowledged that it won't be easy getting broadband companies to invest in rural areas, but he says it's something that John McCain is committed to doing. What is Senator Obama's plan for this?
Well, there again, you have a stark difference between the two candidates. Senator McCain has not been supportive of the Universal Service Fund in the country. That is a mechanism that we've used for decades in this country to get phone service into rural areas. Senator Obama embraces it. Because the reality is, if we rely simply on the free market, there will be many people in this country that will have to do without. And Senator Obama believes that this is not just a question of access to technology. This is fundamentally about economic development. It's about making sure that people in rural areas can participate in the information age.
When you talk to tech analysts and tech advisors who fall on the Republican side of the divide, they say that he should take a much more hands-off approach and that the best way to allow technology and technology policy to develop is to allow sort of market forces to prevail.
Well, I've heard this argument, and I believe that it's a caricature, but it also typically promotes a more big business agenda. We didn't get here with a robust internet in this country with a hands-off approach. It required not only government investment and research, but also ensuring that we had open networks so people could access the dial-up internet. So the argument that Senator Obama is too intrusive or it's sort of a command and control approach really contradicts the whole history of how we've gotten to this point to date.
Bill Kennard, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Kennard is a former FCC chairman and an advisor on technology and media issues for the Obama campaign. One final note, in our conversation, Mr. Kennard mentioned a program that was debated during his tenure at the FCC. The program provides schools with discounted access to the internet. Mr. Kennard said that Senator McCain opposed that program. In fairness, we're also seeking comment from the McCain campaign to clarify Senator McCain's position on that program. You've probably seen these people walking down the street a lot lately, and by these people, we mean the ones with their eyes focused on their cell phone or BlackBerry, thumbs all aflutter as they fire off text messages, totally oblivious to their surroundings. Maybe you're one of them. Text walkers have become a symbol of the multitasking age. but they can be a danger to themselves and to others. At least one state, Illinois, is considering a fine to curtail the behavior. Joining me on the line is Angela Gardner. She's an emergency doctor at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. Dr. Gardner, I take that text walking is enough of a problem that the American College of Emergency Physicians issued an alert about it?
Yes, it is a big problem and growing bigger every day.
What kinds of things are you seeing and hearing about?
Well, I saw a patient almost 2 years ago now who was my first text injury. She was a young lady in her early 20s who was walking down the sidewalk in my hometown, and she was sending a text message. She missed the end of the curb and fell off into the street, into the path of an oncoming car. The driver of the car was on his cell phone. When he saw her fall, he overcorrected, and his car ran into a light pole. I treated both patients in the emergency department.
Did either person involved in that accident walk away from the saying, I will never text walk again?
Well, the young lady was a little bit embarrassed about what happened, so I think she probably will not. The gentleman who was on the phone actually had said that he was going to get a headset.
You know, this is the kind of thing that I guess I understand why the American College of Emergency Physicians would issue an alert about this, but it also seems like common sense that maybe you put these kinds of devices down if you need to be paying attention.
Well, you would think so. The actual use of the cell phone to send a text message requires a visual concentration. If you take your eyes off the road for a minute and when you're driving, that'll cause a wreck. If you're even walking and you are concentrating on a screen, you can step in a hole or just step incorrectly and end up injured.
Doctor, now you mentioned an anecdotal example, but are there any kind of statistics to suggest that there's a veritable uptick in these injuries?
I don't have any hard data that would suggest that. I can tell you, though, that when I first saw that patient, I wrote about her on my own little personal blog because it was such an unusual story. Now I see one of these a week or so.
One a week?
Yes.
Now, aside from not doing it, from putting away the phone or the BlackBerry, what are some things that people can do to be a safe text walker if they insist on walking while texting?
Well, the most common sense thing is to just stop. If you have to send a text message, get out of the path of the traffic of the sidewalk and stop. Send the message and then go on.
Now, we mentioned one state, Illinois, is now considering making text walking a misdemeanor that would be worth a $25 fine. Think that might make a difference?
I actually don't think that's a very enforceable law. They would be and have to stand on the street corner and just issue a ticket to everybody walking by.
Well, not everybody.
Well, almost everybody.
Do you ever text walk?
Yes, and I'll tell you what's happened to me is that because I'm not part of the 20-year-old multitasking generation that can do three IMs at the same time they're talking on the phone, I actually have to stop and concentrate on sending a text message. So I will stop and send the message and then go on.
Angela Gardner is an emergency doctor at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. Dr. Gardner, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.